Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The subject is John Maynard Keynes, thinker and writer of genius and consequence in England between the two world wars. He is back to life in a dazzling biography of the moral philosopher inside The Famous Economist. Zachary Carter is our guest. He has rewritten the life story, emphasis on the humanity of Keynes's thinking and the artistic beauty of his prose. Keynes was an economist mostly without numbers, though he had started out as a mathematician. He makes literary and moral connections back to Edmund Burke, the 18th century Anglo-Irish conservative, and he implies a sort of kinship with George Orwell, another radical but anti-revolutionary English socialist of Keynes's own period. It struck me reading you, Zachary Carter, that you were reviving Keynes to get us beyond the deficit spending labels of old, but really to tease us with what we're missing in our pretty scary 2020 breakdown time. 100 years ago, and the world was in turmoil then too, Keynes spoke practical wisdom about a nation as an organized community in a voice and with a confident vision that would be hard to find in our public space, much less in our government today or in recent years.
I think that's right. I think Keynes is a very unusual economist in that, perhaps unique among economists, in that he did not look at the economic world really mathematically, the way that we've come to understand economics over the past, you know, century or so. His chief concerns were not things like economic growth or GDP or even the unemployment rate. He was concerned with social stability and social harmony, and also international stability, international harmony, the ability for peoples to hang together and not fight with one another. And I think if he were looking at the world today, you know, even before the pandemic, there were a lot of sort of alarm bells that I think would be going off for him, far beyond deficit spending or you know, unemployment benefits or specific policies that would be used to address a lot of the problems that we've seen arising since the pandemic. He'd be worried about things like climate change. He'd be worried about inequality. He'd be worried, be very worried about the scope of U.S. military action.
That's what we love about this book and about the man. For people of center and left in this country, he's a kind of dream, and he's speaking to us. We wonder, where is our Keynes today? Or maybe it's Keynes. Social stability and social harmony, very conservative, traditional values. I associate them, and I guess he did, with the great Edmund Burke in the 18th century Parliament from Ireland. But he's also a radical, almost, without being a revolutionary at all.
I think you're right about Burke and the anti-revolutionary sentiment. Keynes doesn't fit any of the sort of traditional partisan categories that we're accustomed to right now in the United States. He, for instance, would have been horrified, I think, by the talk of revolution in the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2020. But I think he might have even found Sanders' policy regime a little bit too timid. He was a very big thinker who kept coming up with ideas that were frankly too big for their time, even when the Labour government, which was explicitly socialist government, took over in Britain in the 1920s and early 1930s, they wouldn't implement a lot of the Keynesian ideas about finance because they just thought they were too radical and they would result in problems that would be blamed on the Labour government. He was always coming up with these big grand schemes for how to solve what he saw as the big problem at the root of society. And in his day, it was the international conflict in Europe that was essentially unresolved at the end of World War I. And I think in our time, the class and race divisions in this country have been essentially unresolved since the end of the Civil War. It's something that the country has been fighting with and wrestling with for decades. And, you know, it's made progress at times, and that progress has also receded at others. But I think it was very clear, even before Donald Trump became president, that these tensions were central threads to our social fabric that needed to be mended. So there are a lot of separate issues that I think Keynes would be pointing to and saying these are leading to this society not just becoming unequal, but to it breaking apart into different societies that are not part of the same political project. And that is very dangerous.
And what would he make of Trumponomics, which seems to be fundamentally based on tax cuts, deregulation of environmental protection, clear preference for his own class. But would he see a system there? Would he see a familiar pattern?
Right. I mean, he says that after World War I, he says, look, you know, we are living in a society that would embarrass monarchs of other ages with the riches we have around us and available to the middle class. And over the past century, you know, that abundance has only increased. It's not wealth that Keynes would not have been able to imagine, because he predicted an enormous increase in wealth over the course of the 20th century. But he would be stunned at how much work we do. He would say, why do you spend all of this time, you know, going to the office and repairing roads and bridges when you could be enjoying more leisure time and making art and looking at art and writing poetry? And he thought these were things that could be open to everyone, not just the upper class.
Of course, his England was an unequal society, and his governments in the 30s were more oligarchical in a way than ours. I mean, I think his 11th cousin, George Orwell, was ridiculing them at the time as a sort of, as a feckless aristocracy. What precedent would he see? What warning? What familiarity would he see in our social order?
Well, I certainly see a lot of parallels between the declining British Empire of the early 20th century and the dysfunctional American, I think we can call it an empire, of the early 21st century. The way that Britain was simply unable to meet the economic and social challenges of its time seems very familiar to me. You know, in the United States, we're accustomed to thinking of the Great Depression as something that begins with the stock market crash in 1929. But in Britain, the economic decline begins as soon as World War I ends. They don't call it the Great Depression at first, they call it the slump, but it lasts all the way until World War II. So this is a just total inability for the British government to meet the moment and provide for its citizens. And they have terrible, terrible social unrest. There's a general strike in 1926 that absolutely petrifies Keynes, where all of the major labor unions in Britain just say, we're not going to work anymore. And there is violence in the streets. I mean, they roll out tanks to battle the strikers. The government takes on a very authoritarian turn, which is something that people had not seen in the streets of London for a very long time. Then you think about events in the United States, you know, even before the pandemic, things like the uprising in Ferguson that happened in 2014, things like the Freddie Gray riots in Baltimore. To me, there is a ring of familiarity to that type of unrest, even though, of course, they have an American spin with the American race problem, which is, you know, exists in Britain, but is a very different type of problem than it is here. So I think Keynes would see a government that has a very hard time meeting the actual clear and I think easier to address problems in our own day than they were in Keynes's day. I mean, the type of economic tools that he was talking about using were unheard of at the time. In the United States, we have access to those tools. We just don't use them. And I think he would be baffled by that.
Where is to introduce John Maynard Keynes as the beginning in his birth at Eton, Cambridge, eventually a stalwart pillar of the Bloomsbury Circle of artistic, unconventional stars, Virginia Woolf, E.M. Forster, Lytton Strachey, many more. Maybe the point is World War I, going to the Versailles Conference as a sort of attaché of the British Treasury in negotiating the end of World War I.
World War I is this transformative experience, not only for Keynes, but for all of his friends in the Bloomsbury set. The Bloomsburys, as Virginia Woolf referred to them, were really kind of a progressive, almost a radical sect. They were constantly swapping lovers with each other. They're engaged in all of this incredible activity involving art and letters. But they're not terribly famous when World War I breaks out. You know, Virginia Woolf has not written Mrs. Dalloway, which is her first big hit. That doesn't happen until 1925. They're sort of unknown bohemians who are part of an international community. You know, they're going off to Paris to visit Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso, and then coming home and telling all of their friends, you know, about the great things they saw, you know, across the channel. And they very much think of themselves as citizens, not only of the British Empire, but of the world, as this sort of progressive community that's breaking down the old barriers between peoples in Europe with the power of ideas and art. And Keynes is totally captivated by this ideal, but World War I shatters it.
What is the social ideal? There's an aesthetic. There's a company, a group of modernists, all brilliant in hindsight and even at the time. But what was their social obligation?
Well, it changes over time, to be clear. But certainly as young people, they lived this sort of secluded life of almost aristocratic excess into art and leisure. They want to sit around and talk about the great ideas. There's a philosopher named G.E. Moore, who's one of the great Platonist philosophers of the 20th century, who really is sort of the intellectual godfather of this group. And it gets very technical and philosophical, but he talks about organic unities, these things that cannot be broken down into component parts that constitute elements of a good life. So The exchange of love, the appreciation of a great painting, you can't split that up and divide it. It's sort of its own organic unity. And they thought a good life was the ability to collect as many of these as you can. But as Keynes gets older, he comes to see this as a way of life that everybody can enjoy, that because we're not bound by scarce resources, because we have enough food and clothing and scrap metal to go around, everybody can participate in the type of lifestyle that Bloomsbury enjoyed. But World War I really challenges this worldview because it says, look, while you guys are off talking about art and poetry, you know, there are people fighting and dying. And while you were doing your fun little art games, the political currents of the worst calamity that the world has ever known were building all around you, and you totally missed it. And this is devastating for everybody in the Bloomsbury set. Most of them are pacifists and file as conscientious objectors to the war. Keynes, remarkably, does the same thing, even as he's serving as the head of British war finance. I mean, he says, and there's truth to it, that every dollar that, I guess it's every pound, but every piece of money that the British government spent on the war in World War I passed through his hands. And that's true. So he's deeply conflicted. You know, he wants Britain to win the war. He doesn't want to lose, but he feels like the war is unjust and a waste of time and a totally destructive activity. And so when he gets to the peace conference at the end of the war in Paris, he thinks this is an opportunity to make something good out of these last 4 years. We can set a new foundation for Europe where this type of thing never happens again. And he is totally disillusioned by what happens at the peace conference. He sees people fighting essentially over money when they should be talking about cooperation. And this is very traumatic for him. And he writes a book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which is technically a critique of the economic terms of the treaty, but it's really an attack on the vision of the politicians at the peace conference, saying this was not about peace. This was about resource extraction. And as a result, this continent is on the path to another war. And I think, unfortunately, he was correct in that assessment.
Coming up, the World War I peace agreement that made Keynes's reputation for prophecy in dissent. This is Open Source. John Maynard Keynes saw a spirit of vengeance, not peace, in the Versailles Conference that ended World War I. He foresaw a deliberate impoverishment of Central Europe coming, which he predicted would beget more vengeance and destroy civilization and progress in his generation. And of course, Hitler and World War II affirmed him.
What he does is something that is central to his thinking over the following decades. He says, look, Germany just doesn't have the resources to do this. Whatever you put down on paper, they don't have the timber and the steel and the gold and the actual physical stuff to ship this money to Britain and the United States. So what you will do if you assess this type of payment on Germany is essentially depress trade. You will make it impossible for the economic life of Germany to be revived after the war. He thinks the same thing is happening with Britain and Britain's war debts to the United States. So he believes it's not just the high reparations payments that are being demanded from Germany. He believes that the war debts that the Allies are carrying are also unsustainable, and that the whole financial engine of the treaty is just a mirage. It won't end up working. And in the meantime, it will make people very angry and make people very angry with each other across borders. And he sees that as being fuel not only for dictatorship in individual nations, but for a future conflict.
The question of forgiving debt is still an issue between Germany and Greece, for example, in recent years, but between us and all sorts of clients in the Third World. What did the world learn from that notion that you can't get blood out of a stone and it's not good for the health either of the Germans after the war or the international trading system or anybody?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the world didn't learn very much from that at all. I think if had the world listened to Keynes on Versailles, the gold standard might never have fallen apart in the 1920s. Had the gold standard been managed in a more humane and lenient way towards debtor countries, we may still be living under that system today. But of course, it was not managed in that way. And so Keynesian economics ends up developing as an alternative to the sort of global system of management that persisted in the 1920s, which ultimately ends up being not just an austerity regime in Germany, but an austerity regime across the world, in the United States, in Britain. Every country that is using the gold standard finds that when times get tight, they have to cut, and they have to cut the living standards out from under the feet of their people. And this makes their people absolutely furious. So the gold standard becomes not only a dysfunctional system in which people are not prospering, it becomes a transmission vehicle for international conflict and international enmity. And so eventually the gold standard just breaks down. And we see the end of that with the rise of Hitler in Germany, but also the rise of fascism in Italy. And in the United States, a new system, the New Deal under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which is a sort of new way of organizing society, a new way of thinking about the state that is different from the way that 19th century liberalism had conceived of itself, but is also different from these authoritarian powers that are rising in Europe at that time. So the world changes because it doesn't listen to Keynes. It's totally possible, to my mind, that if the world listens to Keynes, you know, we end up with a completely different international milieu that looks much more like the 19th century, frankly.
Our friend Mark Blythe, the economist at Brown, finds a big point to celebrate in the multi-trillion dollar bailouts from Washington this spring. Good news that they're not talking about cutting budgets or cutting the budgets of middle class and poor people, that austerity is finally dead. Does that make sense?
Things could be worse, but you will see, you're already hearing Republicans talking about cutting directly some of the things that have been extended, like expanded unemployment benefits, but also just by not providing funds to states. It is remarkable that we have not put in place some sort of automatic balance for state governments when the economy reaches a certain threshold. The way we do for unemployment benefits, you know, when you lose your job, you're automatically eligible for unemployment benefits. Congress doesn't have to go and certify each individual check. It's just money that goes out the door when this happens. It's striking to me that when GDP dips below a certain point, we don't just start automatically lifting the economy out and spending the money that needs to be spent to keep people employed. It's something that's, you know, certain parts of the Democratic Party are talking about now, but we really do not do a good job responding to these crises. So Mark Blythe is right that we're doing a better job than Herbert Hoover did in 1929, but we know the lessons and we could apply them much more effectively and efficiently than we do.
Zachary, come back to Keynes's general theory, written in the 1930s, still a kind of cult document. It was a period when he was speaking himself about the opening of a new heaven and a new earth. We were not afraid of anything, he said. Speak of it in its time and in its afterlife.
The general theory is one of the most ambitious works, not only of economics, but of political theory, I think, in the 20th century. It's a very dense work. Parts of it are absolutely beautiful, and parts of it are just almost entirely indecipherable. And there are people who have won Nobel Prizes just interpreting various chapters and ideas from the general theory. But the basic point of the general theory is that economies don't automatically trend towards harmony and equilibrium. They don't of their own have this sort of life that leads to prosperity. They have to be managed. And if they aren't managed, you will end up in what Keynes calls an equilibrium of underemployment. And by this, he means depression. So the Great Depression is what happens when governments just expect and wait for the economy to work out. It doesn't. And I think it was a very compelling argument to make at the time, because you could just see that things had not gone well. If no matter how badly governments had mismanaged the crisis over the preceding years, at some point, things should have corrected. There should have been some natural momentum towards improvement or prosperity. But particularly in Britain over the course of the 1920s, there just wasn't any. So we've had 16, 17 years of depression in Britain. You've had about a decade of depression in the United States, so it depends on which sector. You know, the agricultural sector in the United States is in depression throughout the 20s as well. Keynes believes that we're having this economic downturn not because we're out of resources, not because there aren't enough, you know, beans or potatoes to go around, but because we've misunderstood the way investors make decisions and the way money works in society. That economics traditionally looks at human beings as these rational actors who make decisions to maximize their profits going forward into the future. But the bare fact of the matter is that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We are governed inextricably by uncertainty. We don't really know what an investment's going to bring in the future any more than we know about, you know, what an explorer might find on an expedition to the South Pole, he says. And this is true for small events like, you know, corporate profits. It's also true for big events like wars that you don't see coming. And Keynes certainly did not see World War I coming. When these uncertain events are governing our lives, people can just quite reasonably decide to be very conservative about how they spend their money. I don't mean conservative in an ideological way. Just be very careful about what they spend on and choose not to spend. And when they don't spend, economic activity is not happening. And this isn't because there isn't enough stuff. It's just because people are feeling psychologically concerned about the future. And so governments have to exercise leadership, not just economic and financial leadership to spend the amount of money, but to encourage people to believe in a better future, to make them not only hope, but actually believe that tomorrow will be better than today. So it's okay to go out and take that risk of spending money, of investing in a new idea, of enjoying a vacation. And I think that psychology is just terribly important in this moment, where whatever happens with COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus, there will be a time when the medical emergency is over. But people are going to be traumatized by this event for months and years to come. And we will need political leadership to help us realize the type of life that we all want to have, but maybe we're afraid that we can't have. And so that is going to be, I think, an enormous challenge. And it's not a challenge of dollars and cents or debt and deficits, but of confidence and faith in each other. It's a very difficult thing for governments to muster when things are bad, but Keynes believes that it's really central to progress and to prosperity.
Two links there that everybody knows, in a sense. In the long run, we're all dead, by which you really meant deal with the condition of your life and your country now, but also the invention in this general period or general sense of the word macroeconomics, the idea of an infinitely complicated but still minutely connected overall system, which must be seen and regulated from time to time and loved and nurtured and monitored.
Macroeconomics, as we understand it today, did not exist before the general theory. It's really something that economists start to develop because of the general theory. And it's the idea that the economy as a whole operates according to a different kind of logic than the logic of individual households or individual firms and businesses. The principles which guide individual behavior don't seem to function the same way in an economy in the big picture. So what's good for a household, I should save a lot of money when you know times are tight, is very bad for an economy, because if everybody's saving money when times are tight, then no economic activity is happening. The economics profession has never really been able to reconcile the tension between these two ways of thinking about the world. It's sort of like in physics, the way theories about, you know, very small atomic particles, subatomic particles, you know, make sense at the molecular level or the submolecular level, but don't make sense when applied to large bodies in space, to planets and galaxies and things like that. I don't know if economists will find a way to reconcile them. I think, frankly, the profession has become interested in accounting issues so much so over the past few decades that it's lost sight of this idea of prosperity that was so central to Keynes.
But I got to ask you, I mean, in our day, Keynesian deficits would be unrecognizable, and they're forever. They don't stop. Is this Keynesian thinking triumphant, or is it a kind of gross caricature of endless debt?
I don't think Keynes would be concerned about debt as such. The idea that you need to pay back the debt, you know, that's fine. He wouldn't have a problem with that. But the United States has control over its currency. It can always create more dollars and pay off investors if it wants to. The question is the shape of the society and the distribution of resources. So I don't know if there's a certain amount of money that Keynes would say, oh my goodness, this is too much. The government can't afford this. He would be saying, okay, you know, how many airplanes can we build? How many ditches can we dig? How many bridges can we repair? How many people can we put to work? And it would be the economic activity of these real resources that would motivate him. The accounting sort of portion of it, the size of the debts, I don't know that that would be a problem for him, but he would certainly be worried about some of the ways that this debt has been accumulated. He would look at the inequality produced by the tax cuts over the past few years and be very critical of that. But he'd be looking at the way that the spending and the policymaking affected society more so than he would be thinking about the effect of the debt itself on social conditions in the future.
Right. He would sooner or later remind you, I think, that his great goal is full employment in a certain way. I mean, that's the simplest goal. Maybe that's the simplest way to state it. It's not about the numbers. It's about the health of families and communities.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And by the end of the war, you know, Britain is essentially about as broke as you can be. They've been suffering under the Blitz for years. They've had millions of people killed in the war. Resources have been stretched to the limit in order to fund the war machine. And Keynes comes back from that and says, okay, look, we have an industrious, hardworking society. Let's provide health care free at the point of service to everybody in Great Britain. And he becomes the financial architect of the National Health Service. He goes around promoting a program to build theaters. This is in the era before television. So theater is a very, very big part of social life in Britain at the time. And says, look, we need to build community theaters in every county throughout Britain so that people have a place they can go to enjoy the finer things in life. Mm-hmm. And these do not just have to be things that are dictated from Hollywood or from London. You know, we should have local playwrights and local actors and local musicians performing in these spaces. And he believes that Britain has the ability to do this because Britain has the people who can do it. And so anything that we can actually do, he says, we can afford. And I think that's an important thing to remember, particularly as we confront things not just like COVID-19, but the climate change disaster that appears to be on the horizon. This is something that people can, in fact, deal with if we want to, but we have to decide to do it.
Surely Keynes would be taking some satisfaction in the oddball Tory Boris Johnson praising that National Health Service for saving his life.
Oh, I think absolutely. Keynes, throughout his life, was a liberal. So in Britain, that's sort of the moderate center party at a time when the Labour Party is the socialist left party and you have the conservative Tories on the right. Keynes becomes, you know, allied with the Labour Party over time, even though he identifies as a liberal, but he never identifies as a conservative. And he thinks the conservatives are just sort of wayward, and he just has all sorts of terrible things to say about them throughout his life. And I think he would have been very critical of David Cameron's austerity regime for most of the past decade, and I think he would simply be baffled by Boris Johnson. I don't know what he would make of him, really. But the fact that that National Health Service has survived and is really politically bulletproof in Britain, I think is a remarkable achievement. You know, in the United States, we think of Keynes as the guy who is, you know, sort of the intellectual godfather of the New Deal and maybe the Great Society as well under Lyndon B. Johnson. But in Britain, being the financial architect of the National Health Service is a pretty big deal.
What would he make, Zachary, of the complete disarray of British politics? And not to mention the Thatcher years that preceded it.
The Thatcher years are harder, I think, to explain. But certainly the last decade or so, Britain, like many countries, just didn't deal well with the fallout from the 2008 financial crisis. And I don't think Keynes would be surprised. He'd be disappointed, but I don't think he would be surprised by the disarray that you see in Britain and in the United States and in much of Europe. He thinks that events like financial crises are psychologically destabilizing for people. And he thinks that the turn to austerity that happened after World War I is responsible for the rise of fascism across Europe. And frankly, you know, there was a very, healthy is the wrong word, but there was a very significant fascist movement in the United States at the time as well. It just didn't become politically triumphant. So Keynes would look at the authoritarian turn in international affairs after 2008 and say, look, I told you so. I think he would find that very predictable. I think the Thatcher years are a little bit thornier. You know, a version of Keynesian economics is really dominant throughout the Western world until the late 1960s. And then with the rise of inflation in the late 1960s and early 1970s, a school of thought led most prominently by Milton Friedman, but you know, participated in by much of the economics profession, says that it's the Keynesian deficits and the Keynesian spending that are responsible for this rise in inflation. And if we want to control this new economic problem, we have to stop using the economic techniques of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. That becomes a rationale for a sort of rearrangement in power dynamics in both Britain and the United States, in which organized labor and the public sector take on a diminished role politically and a diminished political significance, and corporations, but particularly financial institutions, start sort of calling the tune, not only economically, but politically. So you had in the 1960s, these very large conglomerates that had a great deal of power, companies like, you know, General Electric or General Motors, but they were the people who really called the shots in the economy. Banks like JP Morgan Chase did not call the shots. Whereas beginning in the 1970s, 1980s, it's financial institutions, large banks, hedge funds, and private equity firms that start taking over a dominant role in the way resources are organized and distributed. This really accelerates with globalization in the 1990s. A lot of the trade agreements that are agreed to are about giving finance the sort of upper hand in corporate and political relationships.
Zachary Carter is our guest. He's found the moral philosopher inside the economist John Maynard Keynes. Coming up, life in the long run after Keynes. Would he still say all things are possible? This is Open Source. We're speaking about the economist John Maynard Keynes, who practiced his compound art and science, for the most part, without numbers. His ideal in the profession was England's Alfred Marshall. And in tribute, he described the complexity of the economist's assignment this way. He must be mathematician, historian, statesman, philosopher, in some degree. He must understand symbols and speak in words. He must contemplate the particular in terms of the general and touch abstract and concrete in the same flight of thought. No part of man's nature or his institutions must lie entirely outside his regard. He must be purposeful and disinterested in a simultaneous mood, as aloof and incorruptible as an artist, yet sometimes as near the earth as a politician. A formidable writer, too.
An incredible writer. I don't know if anyone who has ever called themselves an economist has had the way with words that Keynes had. But that description, to me, does not sound like what we think of today as an economist or as somebody who would be...
That's what we want.
Right, right. But it doesn't sound like what you learn to do in an American business school. It sounds like a description of one of the great Enlightenment thinkers, somebody like David Hume or Adam Smith, who is capable of thinking about ethics and politics and economics as part of this holistic vision of both the good life and the good society. And I think a lot of economics today has become divorced from that broader vision and has become mathematized into a set of symbols themselves. Keynes was not anti-mathematics.
No.
In fact, by the end of his, he's a very good mathematician. In fact, he did not major in economics as an undergraduate. He studied mathematics. And by the end of his life, he talks about a coming age of joy through statistics because we have all of this new economic data that did not exist in his time. There was no GDP in the 1930s because it just didn't exist. No one had developed the data. So,
but speak Zachary, to that missing element in our world today. I mean, the Bob Rubins and Larry Summers don't rise to that challenge. Who does? I remember John Kenneth Galbraith, who did. He was a superb writer himself and loved to speak of economics without numbers also. Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia, who loves your book, has that same versatility. He's also in and out of government. He knows absolutely everybody and thinks of the whole and now the world. But why don't we know more? Who hasn't taken the bait?
Economics today is sort of it's almost like a priesthood that we would think of in sort of like ancient Rome or ancient Greece. Economists provide legitimacy to policies and ideas that politicians and interest groups in society want to see implemented. This does not mean that economists are inherently corrupt or the profession is dishonest. It's just the way they function socially. So people turn to an economist, and an economist puts a good faith effort, hopefully, into showing that something is a good idea. This is not the work of a philosopher. This is the work of a technician or of a priest who's saying, this will work. If you listen to me, this thing that you want to do will work out okay. They're reinforcing ideas that are already dominant in society. This thirst for philosophical debate and for philosophical exploration really comes from his years in Cambridge with the philosophy department. He doesn't think he's going to be an economist when he's a young man. He thinks he's going to be a philosopher. He's buddies with Bertrand Russell and Ludwig Wittgenstein, and they're constantly talking about the nature of truth and Keynesian ideas about uncertainty that become so central to his economic theory are really about a theory of rationality that he's trying to develop as a philosopher at Cambridge as a young man. And look, there are people in the world right now who are trying to revive that idea. I think Joseph Stiglitz has done a lot of good work in this respect. I think Stephanie Kelton, one of the people who's associated with modern monetary theory, is very good about talking about values in addition to numbers. And I think Jeff Sachs, particularly in his recent work, has been quite good at it. I'm very happy that he likes my book. So
I should have mentioned Joseph Stiglitz. There are lots of others. But bring it home, Zachary, in the sense of bringing that holistic imagination that John Stuart Mill or any of the great Enlightenment thinkers to the incredible predicament we feel we're in now. COVID, a deep recession, maybe worse in store in our economy, and then global warming coming at us. Sit Lord Keynes down with us. What do we got to know? What do we got to notice? Where do we see our hope? How do we measure our strength?
I think Keynes would look at the global order today and say, we have to acknowledge that this is not working and that this is not sustainable. It was not going well before COVID-19, and it's certainly not going well during the pandemic. It will take years to develop a new global system based on cooperation and mutual respect, something like the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944, where Keynes himself was one of the most important delegates, to bring people together to negotiate a new sort of order. But until that time, countries are going to have to sort of go it alone a little bit. And the way that they're going to get through it is by coming together and taking care of each other.
Explain what that means in terms of trade or trade rivalries, trade wars for that matter, independence, nationalism.
Sure. Keynes was a free trader throughout his life. He loved the idea of free trade, but he also supported tariffs at various points because he felt like when the winds of global trade got out of control, it could do devastating things to sectors of domestic economies. And that devastation would be inhospitable to social harmony at home and would fuel international political rivalry and enmity. So he believed that in order to rescue this sort of grand internationalist vision that he and everybody in Bloomsbury had always cherished, at times countries would have to take care of themselves. And he describes this in the general theory. In fact, he says, if countries can create full employment at home through national policies, then international trade will become a much better and harmonious system. And at the time, the types of things that Keynes was talking about, you know, running large deficits in order to employ people, that was considered a violation of free trade. That if governments were employing people in order to put them to work while the international market said, you know, there shouldn't be anybody working there, then you were breaking with the norms of the free trade ideology of the time. I think it's a symbol of his intellectual triumph that we no longer think of government spending that way. But this was a very big deal in the 1930s, certainly within the economics profession. And I think today he would say, look, you know, we don't need to have a rivalry with China. The United States does not need to escalate tit for tat with China on tariffs and various issues, but we have to find a way to address inequality here at home. And that means making sure that people in particularly vulnerable sectors of the economy have work to do It also means making sure that we have a safety net that is functional so that when people are out of a job, they have access to the basic tools of a decent lifestyle. And he would be very concerned about the political inequality in this country, the unequal access to the levers of power and to representation by people in government. He would find that, I think, deeply troubling and say that it's just not sustainable. The country will not be able to be governable if this persists. And you know, I think some of the real catastrophes we've seen over the past decade or so are evidence of that ungovernability arising from inequality. So he would be focused very deeply on finding ways to eliminate or at least alleviate economic inequality.
But you say that people must have work to do, unemployed mm-hmm. people. What is the work to do?
Well, I think the biggest challenge that we need to meet is the climate crisis. We need to find a way to refit our entire economy in such a way that it does not poison the planet and call on an era of mass death, frankly. So he would be talking about investments in new ideas. He'd be talking about retrofitting buildings. He'd be talking about changing the way that we produce electricity. There is never a shortage of work to do, because human problems, unfortunately, are just about limitless. But we have a really big one coming over the horizon with the climate crisis. And I think he would see that as something that markets can't do on their own, that markets have a role to play and a way to influence the solution to that problem, but that's really something where political leadership is required. And not political leadership of just setting standards, political leadership of actually putting people to work.
As you speak, Zachary, it strikes me the politician he might want to be engaged with is AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in the sense of getting rational about retrofitting the country, starting with the energy system, dealing with the climate, but also with employment. I mean, is anybody else quite so Keynesian as AOC?
I think there's AOC has advisors who I think are deeply Keynesian when she talks about MMT and modern monetary theory. I think this is just kind of a spin on a particular strand of Keynesian thought. You know, I think both the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren campaigns were talking about ideas in the way that Keynes would have applauded. And I think some of the more moderate campaigns too. But the fundamental uniting force between all of those people is the belief that the problems that face us are not beyond our ability to address.
Right, in that sense, he'd like Andrew Yang, I think.
Yeah, I think the ambition of a program like UBI, I think universal basic income that Andrew Yang talked about, I think Keynes would applaud. And the fact that they were serious ideas, that they were ambitious enough to meet the scope of the problem, I think that is what he would find so compelling. He wouldn't be worried about the arithmetic so much as the sort of passion and optimism, I think, of those proposals.
How would he take us through the rhetorical contradiction between lockdown and open up? Lockdown so you can open up, but lockdown how long till when? The urgencies on both sides. How would he guide us?
Keynes is always very clear that we should leave science to scientists. So I think he would first say people who know about public health and people who know about biology and viruses should be doing the work necessary to determine when it is safe for people to go out. He would view the public health crisis as the most immediate thing that we need to address, almost as a matter of course. I think he would be kind of shocked at how much of the economic recovery package or packages that have been passed just don't really have much to do with public health or medical emergencies. So he would be talking about, you know, let's make sure that we have contact tracers and nurses trained and, you know, the equipment that every doctor needs. And then we listen to scientists and listen to the latest research and determine when it's safe to get back out. But after that, once you have the pandemic under control, then it's time for political leadership to convince people that in fact the pandemic is under control and it's time to go and live our lives again. I think he'd be very concerned by the way that the country is sort of polarized into people who are pro-mask or anti-mask or in favor of staying home forever under all circumstances and shaming people who go out into parks and people who say, you know, I should be allowed to, you know, cough in somebody's face because that's my freedom. these are not good ways to think about the problem, and they're evidence of a society that is splitting apart rather than coming together.
Speaking of splitting apart, I mean, what would he make of the unbelievable concentrations of wealth in this country, and the figures embodying it, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates. I mean,
I think he would be stunned. In the general theory, he says that, you know, some inequality of wealth can be justified, that it's not necessary that everybody in society have the same amount of everything. But he says, you know, I think that inequality on the scale that exists today, and this is 1936, is not justifiable, either morally or economically. Today, of course, inequality is much, much more severe than it was in 1936, not just of wealth and income, but of life expectancy. Hmm. You know, life expectancy in the United States has declined for the last 2 years that it's been measured. It's the first time that's happened since World War I. And we've had a lot of calamities over the century between World War I and today. So that's happening not because rich people are dying off. It's happening because people who we describe as working class are dying from deaths of despair, whether it's from opioid abuse or alcoholism. Right. The problem is not just a mathematical problem of some people having more money. It's people living in different worlds. And he would see that as being a very, very troubling thing, not only for political stability, I think, but also just as a matter of morality. He often talked about wealth accumulation as a sort of grotesquerie, something that was sort of dirty or unclean, that what you really want to do is enjoy the thing in itself. You know, you want to go see the painting, you want to enjoy nice activities, but having large amounts of money was sort of a sign that you hadn't lived your life to the fullest because, of course, you had all this money lying around, you hadn't spent it. And I think he would want people to be living those lives, certainly not living the types of lives that most working people live today.
Zachary Carter, we end up, as you do in your book, with that wonderful Keynesian paradox of feeling, in the long run, we're all dead, and in the long run, all things are possible. Work it out for us.
He was a man of many contradictions, but in the long run, we're all dead isn't a statement of pessimism. It is a statement of the need to seize the moment and take action, because in the long run, things are not just going to work themselves out. In the long run, life is over. In 1942, he says, look, it is true that I've said in the long run, we are all dead. But in the long run, almost anything is possible if we
almost
seize the moment. Almost. Not, you know, he didn't believe that, you know, pigs could fly. Although perhaps if you invested enough into, you know, new pig biotechnology, you could make them some wings. He certainly would have applauded that level of creativity. Mm-hmm. He believes that in the long run, almost anything is possible, but only if we seize the moment now. And so he's very critical of this sort of Victorian virtue of thrift, that we must always be saving for tomorrow and the future. He says the future may never come, certainly not if we don't seize the day today.
Mm. Zachary Carter, it's a wonderful book and an intoxicating sort of example of a public life.
I don't think there's anyone who has lived the life that John Maynard Keynes lived. He was not merely a philosopher or an economist. He was also a statesman. He created the National Health Service, an institution that survives today. And he was one of the dominant figures at the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944, which reshaped the global economic and financial order for decades. These are extraordinary things. For any of these is an extraordinary thing for one life. And yet he did them all. And his best friend was Virginia Woolf, one of the greatest English writers ever.
Well, I was going to say, never having read The General Theory, but tempted now, he's one of the great writers of modern times, as a stylist, as a penetrating, thinking wordsmith. He's incredible.
I would caution you against reading The General Theory if what you're after is great style, but almost everything else he wrote is just beautiful. The General Theory can be a thorny pretzel. but you know, his essays in biography, his essays in Persuasion, there's a collection of just political essays that he wrote in the 1920s and 30s. They're just beautiful. He wrote an essay on Isaac Newton, which is one of the most magical pieces of writing I've ever read.
Wow. An all-round marvel, for sure. And you've written a wonderful life. Thank you, Zachary Carter.
Thanks so much for having me.
Zachary Carter's book is titled The Price of Peace: Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Visit our website for our series of programs on the coronavirus and our extraordinary music-making conversation with the one and only Yo-Yo Ma. It's all at radioopensource.org. And while you're there, please subscribe to our world's first and longest-running podcast and think about supporting the hardest-working team in radio. The best way is by subscribing to us on Patreon. You can hear producer Adam Coleman's series of interviews on close reading in a time of social distance. This week, he talks about fiction and doom with Jenny Offill, author of the celebrated new novel, Weather. To hear it, just go to patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our philosopher economist. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.